Yeah, I was like, what the fuck?
Okay, so I don't yet have your test graded. Your test will come back on Friday, I'm sure. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to move forward with the course. We're now having introduced a lot of abstract stuff. So, and we began the course just doing calculation, mostly row reduction, and finding things to do with that. And then since the first midterm, we've been concentrating on abstract things like subspaces, bases, linear independent, linear transformation. Now we're going back to things that you'll find are applicable directly in your applications. Today we're going to talk about determinants, which are certain functions. When you have a square matrix, there's a certain functions of the entries of that matrix that allow you to determine lots of properties of the matrix. I'll review some of those in a second. But the surprising thing is going to be is that once we have knowledge of the determinant, for many purposes, we can avoid the row reduction algorithm. We can use determinants to solve linear systems. We can use determinants to invert matrices, et cetera. What's nice about the formulas that are going to come out of that is the determinants are an explicit function. You just plug numbers into the function, you get a result. That's different than the sort of algorithms we've been using thus far in our calculations, where you start row reducing a matrix, but you have no idea what the end result, the row echelon form, is going to look like until you start working through the steps and see what happens as you go through the calculation. So what's going to be nice when we get in the discussion of determinants is we actually get a function that we can stare at and see some general properties of. And will actually help us understand what's going on a little bit better. Okay, so let me get started. Let me first remind you of what the textbook calls the fundamental theorem of invertible matrices. Like the fundamental theorem of calculus that relates integration to differentiation, you know, sort of, you know, independently defined things are actually turn out to be closely connected via fundamental theorem. So too for in linear algebra, if we have any n square matrix, then the following five statements are all equivalent, meaning if any one of them is true, then all is true. So for example, if you have a square matrix, either the inverse exists or it doesn't. But if the inverse does exist, that's going to imply that anytime you have a linear equation where you use A as the coefficient matrix, you're going to get a unique solution. And an equivalent condition is that if you have, x equals zero is always a solution of this equation. But if A is if A is invertible, then in fact, x equals zero is the only solution of this equation. And another thing we've seen is that if A has an inverse, then A has to be row reducible to the identity matrix. That comes directly from our calculation. So when we try to compute A to the minus first, our algorithm starts with adjoining to our given matrix, the identity matrix, doing row reduction until we reach the reduced row echelon form, of this matrix, I adjoined with A. And what's going to happen is that this reducer echelon form is either going to look like the identity matrix and something else. And in fact, if this is the case, if the A part reduces to the identity matrix, then what's going to happen to the identity matrix under the same row reduction is we're going to get A the minus first. Or if we get something else, then it doesn't matter what happens here. This means there's no inverse. All right, so this, I'm just reviewing that calculation just to tie in this fact that a matrix is going to have an inverse only if the reduced row echelon form of that matrix is exactly the identity matrix. But in fact, the way we prove this theorem is by analyzing the algorithm we use to compute each step. And in fact, if you look at this, whether I compute A the minus first, whether I solve this linear system, or I solve this linear system, row reductions involved. And in fact, the way these identities are proving, you frequently end up counting the number of pivots in a row echelon form and verifying that's the case. Oh yeah, and the last one is that the rank of A is equal to the number of columns. This is just saying that when you the dimension of the column space of this matrix is equal to n. And that's going to happen because how would we get the dimension of the column space? We would row reduce A to a row echelon form. And for each column in the row echelon form that have a pivot, we get a basis vector. Well, if every for the identity matrix, every column has a pivot. And so all columns of the original matrix should be used. And so the rank would be A, n. Anyway, so this much is review. We covered this before the first exam. Now, what I'm going to do today is I'm going to add a new item to this list of equivalent situations. I'm going to define a function called the determinant. When as soon as I evaluate that function, think of it as simple as evaluating x squared, except there'll be more variables. As soon as I evaluate that function using the entries of A, I'll get some number. If the number is not equal to zero, I'll know that the matrix is invertible. If the number is equal to zero, I know that none of these statements is true. So it's a simple function that will tell us a lot about a matrix that we're working with. Okay, so the way I'm going to introduce it is I'm going to try to write down a function that when it's not equal to zero, I know a matrix is invertible. When it is equal to zero, I know the matrix is not invertible. And I'm going to start with some small matrices so you can see that how this can actually be carried out. So what we'll do, I'm just saying I'm going to have some function that will, once I know what a matrix is, a number should pop out of that by just plugging into a formula and calculating. All right, so here's the basic example. Suppose I have a matrix with one row and one column, so it just has a single entry, and I want to look for conditions of when this matrix is invertible. Well, that means I want to find a matrix B so that when I multiply this matrix by B, I get the identity matrix. Let's write down another one-by-one matrix. We take the product, we get product of the entries, and we need that to equal one in order to match up with the identity matrix. Well, that's going to mean that this auxiliary matrix B has to be exactly 1 over A. Otherwise, the multiplication A times B would not equal 1. So this matrix is going to have an inverse as long as I can find this matrix B, which means I need to construct a matrix whose sole entry is 1 over A. And I won't be able to do that if A is equal to zero, right? Because you can't divide by zero. So here's a simple function. The value of this determinant function on the matrix with a single entry A, well, this A is a number. So the value on this matrix is going to be the number A. And then this function defined that way, taking one by one matrices to numbers, we'll conclude that so long as this number is not equal to zero. So as long as A is not equal to zero, so that we can define the inverse matrix, A is going to be invertible. So that's your first example of the kind of function I'm looking for. It's really simple, though. It's just grabbing the entry of the matrix. It'll get more complicated as we look at larger matrices. Let's do the same thing, or same kind of argument, but now we'll look at a 2x2 matrix. All right, so I'm going to look for a criterion on the entries A, B, C, D that, if satisfied, will tell me that this matrix is invertible. All right, so from the fundamental theorem that we started with, we know that a matrix is square matrix is going to have an inverse only if the reducer echelon form of that matrix is identical to the identity matrix, because effectively that's how you calculate the inverse. Well, let's see what this requires of the original matrix. So I'll start with a matrix, and I'll treat these A, B, C, D as variables, not as precise numbers. And I'll do the row reduction using sort of symbolic algebra rather than explicit numbers. So first thing I'd want to do is, as I'm heading towards reducer echelon form, is get my initial pivot equal to 1. So I'll divide the first row by A. Now I've got a pivot up here. Let's get rid of the pivot below. So I subtract C times the first row from the second row, and use that to replace the second row. I get this guy. Well, let's get rid of this fraction here. And I can do that by simply multiplying the second row by A. Now I'll get AD minus BC. Now I'm at a place where I can start to draw some conclusions. Suppose AD minus BC is equal to zero. Then I've ended up with a matrix that's going to look like 1, B divided by A, 0, 0. And this is already in row echelon form, but it's not equal to the identity matrix. And you won't be able to do any further row operations to get it to look like the identity matrix. So if this entry in this corner here turns out to be equal to 0, this matrix is not going to row reduce to the identity matrix. So what I'll use as my function that tells me whether or not a matrix is invertible is, I'll just use this entry here. And so we'll define the determinant of a 2x2 matrix to be exactly this quantity, the difference of the diagonal products, A times D minus B times C. And with that definition of the determinant, we define it that way, then effectively the calculation on the preceding slide tells me that the determinant of this matrix not equal to zero is equivalent to this matrix having an inverse. Now, I'm not computing the inverse, but I'm detecting whether or not it exists or not by evaluating this simple function. And of course, not only does it tell me that the inverse exists, it tells me everything that was stated in that first theorem is true, that AX equals B will always have a unique solution, that the rank of the matrix of a 2x2 matrix is going to equal 2 if its determinant is not equal to 0. So all that information will follow simply by plugging in whatever numbers. So if you had a matrix, suppose A is equal to 1, 2, 3, 4, then its determinant, according to this formula, would be 1 times 4 minus 2 times 3, and so that's going to equal what? Negative 2. Since that number is not equal to 0, I will know immediately that this matrix is not invertible because its determinant is negative 2 rather than 0. And in fact, the only kind of matrix, only 2x2 matrix for which the matrix will not be invertible are those for which AD minus BC is exactly equal to 0. Okay, so I've done thus far. We know that the determinant of a 1x1 matrix is simply its only entry. the determinant of a 2x2 matrix is equal to the difference of the diagonal products. And I'll give you a formula now. I don't think I'll write it on the whiteboard. I'll give you another example, though. For a 3x3 matrix, you can do the same thing. You can plug in symbolic entries into a 3x3 matrix, and then just try to do the symbolic algebra that row reduces this thing to a Denypi matrix. So you maybe divide the first row by A, and then you use that pivot one to clear out entries below, and then you move into the smaller matrix and do the same thing. What's going to happen is eventually you're going to get to a matrix where in that lower corner you get something, an expression that ends up looking like this at the very end. And what you would need in order to be able to row reduce this matrix to the identity matrix is it's going to turn out that this particular function of the entries of the matrix cannot equal zero. Effectively, it's going to appear in a denominator somewhere, and so you can't divide by it. And so that would prevent you from actually inverting that matrix. And so you take this function, take that as a definition of what the determinant of this 3x3 matrix would be. And then, as in with the preceding examples, it's just a function that we can evaluate as soon as we have explicit numbers for the entries of the matrix. Evaluating that function will tell us whether or not the matrix is invertible, whether or not we have unique solutions to linear systems where A is the coefficient matrix, and other stuff as well. All right, now the hard thing about determinants, though, is that I've gone up as far as 3x3, and already it's starting to get complicated. It's a polynomial in the entries of the matrix where I have 6 terms. If I try to do a 4x4 matrix the same way, too horrendous. It's okay doing row reduction when you have numbers like 1, 2, 3, or 4, et cetera. But when you're doing everything symbolically, nothing is going to simplify you. 2 plus 3, you could simplify that by 5, but A and B is not going to simplify to anything simpler. And so rather than try to develop determinant formulas for larger matrices using row reduction, what I'm going to do instead is identify the pattern that we see in these first 3 cases, and then I'll state a theorem that says that pattern actually holds for larger matrices as well. Okay, so to state the pattern, I need to make a simple digression. Suppose I have a square matrix, so n rows and n columns. What I'm going to define is an auxiliary matrix that I can attach to A. In fact, I'm going to get an auxiliary matrix, one for each row in each column of the matrix A. Here's the idea. If you have a matrix A equals 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, I'm choosing these entries so that you'll recognize where everything came from in that matrix. There's going to be a matrix that we call the 1, 1 minor of A. Now, what this is, it's going to be this is the 1, 1 entry, right? What I'm going to do to create this matrix is I'm going to eliminate the row and the column that contain the 1, 1 entry. What survives then is going to be this bottom corner of the matrix, 5, 6, 8, 9. So attached to this 3x3 matrix, in this particular entry of the 3x3 matrix, there's a 2x2 matrix. And you can do that for all the entries of a matrix. Take this guy, A, B, C, D, 1, 1 minor, eliminate the row and column that contains the 1, 1 entry, and you're left with a 2x2 matrix, E, F, H, I. There it is. If I look at this entry, that's in the first row and second slot, I eliminate the row and column that contains it. See if I can do this. You're left with a matrix with D, F, G, I. So here I'm trying to cover up the things, but let me just display it. D, F, GI. Those are the entries of A that don't live in the same column or row as the 1-2 entry of A. And similarly, 1-3, we're looking at this entry. We eliminate its row and column. We're left with a 2-by-2 matrix D, E, G, A. All right. So here's my formula for a 3-by-3, the determinant of a 3-by-3 matrix. It involves 6 different terms. But now what I want you to notice is this is A, the 1-1 entry, and then this EI minus FH, it's exactly the determinant of M11. Right, so this is the 1-1 entry, and then this is the determinant of the corresponding minor. Here's the 1-2 entry. And what this is, DI minus FG, is the determinant of this 2-by-2 matrix. And similarly, the third term in the formula for the determinant is the third entry in the first row times the determinant of the corresponding minor. The determinant of the matrix we get by eliminating the row and column that contain the 1-3 entry. And so we get this formula for the determinant of a 3-by-3 matrix. It's first entry in the first row, first column, times the corresponding minor. Entry in the first row, second column, times the determinant of the corresponding minor. Entry in the first row, third column, times the determinant of the corresponding minor. Well, that's business easy. The other thing I want to point out, though, is there's a sign flip every other term. First term comes in with a plus sign, then you get a minus sign, plus sign. If I had a larger matrix, what you would see is that there's a sign flip every other term as you move across a row. All right, so let's look at the earlier examples as well, and you'll see they also follow this pattern. Here's a 2-by-2 matrix. We know from our discussion of the ability to row reduce this matrix to the identity matrix that this matrix is only invertible when AD minus BC does not equal 0. Well, this is element in the 1-1 slot, and then if I eliminate the row and column that contain it, I'm left with just the matrix D. So this term here is A times the determinant of this minor, the 1-1 minor. And then the second term here is this 1-2 entry times the determinant of the 1-2 minor. The matrix I get by eliminating the first row and second column of the original matrix. And so our formula for the determinant looks essentially the same as whether I'm looking at 3-by-3 matrices or 2-by-2 matrices. Each formula works out to be, you move across the first row, you keep the entry of the matrix as a factor, and then you multiply it by the determinant of the matrix you get by eliminating the row and column from the original matrix that contain the given entry. All right, so my claim is that this generalizes that if you have an n by n matrix, then you can compute the determinant of A in terms of the minors of A. The matrices I create from A by eliminating a particular row and a particular column of the original matrix. And so here's what the formula generalizes to. These sign factors, minus 1 to the 1 plus n, I'm just indicating that every other term you get a sign flip. But except for the sign flips, what you're getting are entries of the matrix times determinants of the corresponding cofactor. Now, this formula doesn't give you a nice closed expression. If A is a 5-by-5 matrix, what this formula would do would reduce the computation of a determinant of a 5-by-5 matrix to the computation of a determinants of a bunch of 4-by-4 matrices. But it could be applied recursively. If these turn out to be 4-by-4 matrices, I can apply this formula again and reduce the determinant of a 4-by-4 to the sum of a bunch of the determinants of 3-by-3s. And the 3x3 matrices, their determinants could be expressed in terms of 2x2 matrices. And eventually, you can get it down to a matrix that's small enough that you have a formula for it. Like you get it down to a 1x1 matrix, then you just use the single entry. If you get it down to 2x2 matrices, you can use AD minus BC, that cross-diagonal product. So the idea of this recursive definition of the determinant is to basically gives you an algorithm for calculating the determinant in terms of smaller matrices that if you keep applying the algorithm, eventually you get this a concrete calculation that you can perform. All right, now what, so let me show you how this would work in a 4x4 matrix. Here's a matrix. If we want to compute the determinant, what I would do is I'll march across, say, the first row. I'll grab the first entry. I'll multiply it by the corresponding determinant of the corresponding minus. Then I'll grab the second entry, and I'll compute the determinant of the minor corresponding to that entry. Let me see if I, yeah, here I've actually plugged in. So I have 1 times this matrix here. It's the matrix you get by eliminating the row and column that contain the 1-1 entry of the original matrix. Here's the 1-2 minor, this is the 1-3 minor, and that's the 1-4 minor. Now, of course, I've got some more determinants to compute if I want to get the determinant of the original matrix. But at least I've simplified the problem of calculating the determinant of a 4x4 into the calculating a bunch of smaller determinants. Okay, now we'll finish that calculation in a minute, but I want to give you a more general expression for these kind of formulas. They're called cofactor expansions. And there's actually a number of cofactor expansions that you can apply to a given matrix. So let's see. Here's the statement. If you have any square matrix, and you've defined the corresponding minor. So for each entry in the ith row and jth column of the original matrix, you're going to have a corresponding minor that you create by eliminating the ith row and jth column of the matrix A. And then this will be a formula for the determinant of the original matrix expressed in terms of the determinants of the smaller minors. Now, what's new in this formula, the preceding formulas, I always chose entries in the lying in the first row of my matrix. But in fact, the same formula works no matter which row you choose. So here I'm leaving the index I as some fixed index. It might be 1, 2, or 3. I can use any row I want, but I keep the index I fixed, and then I sum over the columns here. So what this expansion is an expansion. It's referred to as an expansion along the ith row. And what I pick up there are all the elements in the ith row, and they're being multiplied by the determinants of the minors that correspond to those entries. Or there's yet another formula. The other alternative you have is to, instead of working along a row, you can work down a column. So in this formula, I keep the column index fixed. I'll choose some number between 1 and n. That will fix me on a column. And then I move down individual rows by varying this index I and summing up the terms. So my claim is that no matter which formula you use, you always get the same result. No matter which row you start off with or which column you start off with, once you do the final computation, you get exactly the same terms, no matter how you actually set up the sum. All right, so these numbers here, the sine factors and determinants of the corresponding minors, those things are called cofactors. And we'll see later that they have their own individual use as well. But for now, they're just some nomenclature for terms of this sort. The terms that we get by getting a particular sign, the way we get that sign is by we sum the row index and the column index of a given entry, and we just take -1 to that power. So when the row index and a column index sum to an even number, that sign is one. When they sum to an odd number, then you get a minus sign. And then we have the formula. So the first formula is called the cofactor expansion along the ith row. These are your cofactors, and keeping that index I fixed means we're confining ourselves to looking at entries along the ith row. And here, what we do is we keep the column index fixed, and we sum along the entries in various rows. So move up, we move down a column to compute this version. But the important thing about the theorem is it doesn't matter which of these cofactor expansions we employ, we'll still get the same result. All right, so now let me return to the original 4x4 matrix for which I started the computation of determinant. What I did is a couple slides back, we looked at this exact matrix and we did a cofactor expansion along the first row. So I had 1 times the determinant of this 1-1 minor, 0-0-1, 1-1-0, 0-2-1, that's exactly that. Then we have 0 times the determinant of a minor. But since this is going to be multiplied by 0, I don't even have to write down that determinant. It's being multiplied by 0, so it's not going to contribute. Then we get 2 times the determinant of this minor. Looks like 1-0-1, 0-1-0, 1-0-1, exactly that guy. And then we get 0 times the determinant of the 1-4 minor. But since it's being multiplied by 0, I'm not going to get any contribution there. Okay, so this is the computation we did 3 slides back, but where I reduced the determinant, computation of the determinant of a 4x4 matrix to adding up some I expressed it in terms of the determinants of a smaller matrix, these 2 3x3 matrices. And now I can use the same algorithm to compute this determinant. Let's again move across the first row. 0 times the determinant of 1021, 1021, and then I would have 0 times the determinant of 1001, and then I would have 1 times the determinant of, well, when I eliminate that guy, I'm left with the matrix 1102. And then now I've got it, this determinant of a 3x3 expressed as a sum of determinants of 2x2 matrices, and these I'll just compute. So the determinant of this matrix is 1 minus 0. Determinant of this matrix is 1 minus 0. Determinant of this matrix is 2 minus 0. And so we're explicitly able to reduce this determinant to just a simple number. All right, what about this matrix? So I just computed this determinant. Let's look at this guy next. We can do the same thing. However, I want to do something a little cleverer now. I'm going to exploit the fact that this second column has 2 zeros. That's going to mean that I'm not going to have to compute the determinant of this minor or this minor because they're going to be multiplied by 0. And so that's where the advantage of this more general cofactors expansion comes in. If you have a row or column that has lots of zeros, it's going to make the computation much simpler because there'll be determinants of minors that you won't have to compute because they're being multiplied by zeros. So in this case, I think I moved down the second column. So this first contribution of this first term here is going to be 0 because the determinant of the 1-2 minor is going to be multiplied by this factor of 0. Then I have this guy, so I have 1. Here's the correct sign. The way you get the sign factor correct is you add the row index and column index. So this is in the second row, second column, so I go minus 1 to the 2 plus 2. And then the minor I look at is the 2x2 matrix I get by eliminating the row and column that this entry lives in. So that's going to be 1, 1, 1, 1. And then we get the contribution from the last term, which is going to be 0. So the central term is the only thing that survives. And in fact, it doesn't survive either because the determinant of this 2x2 matrix is 1 times 1 minus 1 times 1, or 0. Okay, so there's an example of a full computation. We took a 4x4 matrix, reduced its determinant to a computation of two 3x3 matrices, and then we evaluated determinants of the 3x3 matrices, also by a cofactor expansion formula. But eventually, we were able to reduce our determinants down to a one where we can apply a known formula. Okay. And so in the end, I've now computed these determinants of the 3x3, and I can put everything together to get 2 as the determinant of the original 4x4 matrix. Okay, so what this should tell you is that the determinant of the matrices is going to be kind of tedious in general, because you're not going to get the answer right away. You have to keep reducing the matrices to smaller matrices until you get something that you can actually know the formulas for, rather than the cofactor expansion formula. All right, so but unfortunately, that computation makes it hard to understand what kind of function is going to pop out of that algorithm. You take 4x4, you reduce it to a sum of 3x3s, and then you reduce the sum of 3x3 determinants to a bunch of 2x2 determinants, and then finally you get an answer, but it's hard to predict what that answer looks like. In particular, what kind of function is it? Is it a sine function? Is it a cosine, an exponential function, a polynomial? How do we see the functional properties of a determinant? Well, for that, I'm going to give you a different way of computing the determinant. This way is going to be, it starts off looking more like combinatorics than linear algebra, but let me proceed. I'm going to show you a different way of computing the determinant of a 3x3 matrix, but it's going to require me to make a slight digression. We'll say that a permutation of n is a listing of the numbers 1 through n. So every number between 1 and n is included in this list exactly once. And what the permutation is just taking the numbers 1 through n and writing them in a particular order. For the number, when n is equal to 3, that means I'm looking at numbers 1, 2, and 3. I have this ordering, 1, 2, 3. Or I can have 1 still be the initial number, but I can reverse the order of the last two. So another ordering would be 1 through 2. Or the list could start with 2, and then I might have 1, 3, or 2, 3, 1. Or the list could start with 3, and then I could have either 1, 2, or followed by 2, 1. But what I've listed here are the 6 possible ways of writing the numbers 1, 2, 3 in a particular order. All right, and so, and then I'm going to refer to the standard way of writing the numbers 1 through n in their usual order. I'm going to call that the standard ordering. All right, so I'll show you the reason for these in a second, but before I do that, I want to do one additional thing with these permutations. I want to associate to any one of these a particular sign, either a plus sign or a minus sign, or you can think of plus 1 or minus 1. What it's going to be is I'm going to look at a permutation, and I'm going to try to identify the number of times as I read across pairs of entry appear in order or appear out of order. So in here, we can think of 3 possible pairings, 1 with 2, 1 with 3, and 2 with 3. In this one, 1 and 2 are in order, 1 and 3 are in order, and 2 and 3 are in order as you read across. So this one, this number S, which is going to count the number of times things appear out of order, would be equal to 0. Now here, 1 is before 3, that's okay. 1 is before 2, that's okay. But 3 is not before 2 in the natural order. So this has one sort of discrepancy in the ordering of pairs, And so in that case, S would equal 1. And this last one, let's see. 2 is out of order with 1. 3 is out of order with 2. And let's see. And 1 is out of order with 3 as well. So in fact, this particular permutation has 3 different pairs. 1, 2, 1, 3, and 2, 3, and they're all out of order as you read across that list. And so the value of this number S counts the number of discrepancies in the natural order. It would be 3 for this one. And so the sign would be minus 1 to the third power, or negative 1. All right, so what I'm showing you is that, well, you have a list of numbers. You can always write every possible way of ordering them down. And what I'm giving you in this definition is, for any particular permutation, a way to assign a number minus 1 or plus 1 to it. All right. And so, yeah. So, and here I do a bunch of calculations of these signs. Yeah. Here's that last one I did. Each of these pairs is out of order for this last permutation. And so we get 3 contributions to S. And the end result is going to be minus 1. All right, now, all that was just to set up a formula for the determinant of an n by n matrix, not in terms of determinants of other matrices, but rather directly in terms of the entries of the original matrix. So the way I'm constructing these terms is, notice that the row index in this factor here is in natural order, 1, 2, the next factor would be A, 3, sigma, 3, and then you get to the last factor, A, the row index is N now, and then there's some number between 1 and N that will be sigma N. So what's the sigma is here is just a listing of these numbers in some order. And so don't think of sigma 1 as necessarily equaling 1. It could be the seventh element in this list. But what you see here is that each term in the sum is going to depend on a particular permutation. It's going to be there'll be a sign factor depending on how many times the entries in this permutation, how many times pairs are out of order. It'll be a plus sign or a minus sign. And then these factors here, there's going to be a total of n factors, but these column indices are going to be distributed in some order. They're not necessarily going to be in the natural order 1, 2, 3. And so that's what this, the purpose of the permutation is. It's to change these column indices. But each term here is simply a sign factor times a product of entries of the matrix of A, one from each row, and one factor from each column as well. And when I sum over all permutations, I'm actually constructing all possible products of this form. All possible products where you take an entries from distinct columns and distinct rows and you multiply them together. All right, now I claim that that's another formula for the determinant. Notice that what it does, though, is it expresses the determinant as a polynomial in the entries, right? This is just a product of variables, so it's going to be a polynomial. All right, so I'll show you explicitly with this example. Here's a 3x3 matrix. Here's the possible permutations of the numbers 1, 2, and 3. So if I wanted to compute this determinant, I'm going to sum over all these permutations. I'll have to compute the sign of each permutation, and then the corresponding product. So what you notice, the way I'm getting these factors here is I'm writing the column indices of these factors in the same, to be defined by this permutation. So the row indices are always 1, 2, 3 in each of these terms, but the column indices and these factors are going to depend on what permutation I'm looking at. So here I'll have 1, 3, and 2. And so this expansion is easy to write down once you know what all those permutations are. And in fact, if I plug in explicitly for the A11 entry is A, the A22 entry is E, the A23 entry is, I guess, this is wrong. This should have been A33. It should have been I there. But what happens is when you actually take this data, you plug in, and you also plug in for the signs, you get exactly this. And then just regrouping things, I can recover my earlier cofactor expansion formula. This here, these first two terms, they have a common factor A, so I group them together. And then EI minus FG is just the determinant of the minor corresponding to that entry. So in fact, I do reproduce the cofactor expansion, but it tells me some things about the determinant. First of all, it shows explicitly that the determinant is a polynomial. Second of all, it gives us a way of counting how big that polynomial is. How many terms is it going to have? It's going to have as many terms as we have permutations. Well, how do we count permutations? If you have the numbers 1 through n, and you want to create a new list using just these numbers, well, for this first entry in this reordering of the numbers 1 through n, you have n choices, right? But then the second entry of this permutation, you've used up one of these numbers. For this guy, you're going to have n minus 1 choices because you've already used one. And then the third one, now you've used up two choices. So for that third entry, you're going to have n minus 2 choices. And then finally, you keep moving across. When you finally reach the last guy, well, you've chosen every other number out of this list except one. And so there'll be just one choice here. So how many choices do you have in total? N times n minus 1 times n minus 2, et cetera, down to 1. Or you simply get n factorial choices. So actually, the number of permutations you have is exactly n factorial. And that should scare you. Because while for 3 factorial is 6, perfectly manageable, 4 factorial is 24, kind of bad. 5 factorial is 120. So if I wanted to use this formula to calculate the determinant of a 5x5 matrix, I'd have to expect a polynomial with 120 different terms. If I had a 6x6 matrix, not very big, 720 separate terms. So even though this is a pretty simple formula, it's really hard to write down when you get to a matrix that's any bit much bigger than a 4x4 matrix. Yet, it's a nice formula because you can see directly that this function is a polynomial that's homogeneous, meaning every term has the same number of factors, of variables, has exactly n factors. So the determinant is polynomial of degree n. It has exactly n factorial terms. So because it's so complicated, it's actually a very sensitive function. And we'll be using determinants to detect things about matrices. And this formula, which is not a practical way of computing the determinants, it is nevertheless important because it shows you the functional form, what the determinant really is from the point of view of algebra. It's just a simple polynomial. All right, so I'll stop here today. And what I'm going to do on Friday is giving you a much more expedient way for computing determinants, one that doesn't require you to apply a recursive formula, nor a formula that requires you to list of n factorial different permutations and then use those permutations to compute the determinant. What I'll give you is a way of finding the determinant really quickly using just row reduction. Okay, so I'll stop here today, and I'll see you on Friday.